Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode, and thanks for downloading this second episode of the new Kermode on Film podcast. This episode is coming live from the BFI South Bank in London. I'm just standing outside the bar at the moment. We're about a couple of hours before the regular show I do here once a month, which is called Mark Kermode Live in 3D. It's a show that's been going for about 3 years. It's essentially a conversation with people involved in the film industry. So guests that we've had over the 3 years have included people like Sir Michael Caine, Carol Morley and Amara Santi, Jarvis Cocker, Sam Mendes and Sir Alan Parker. On tonight's show, we've got a great lineup. We've got Hayley Squires, who you may know from I, Daniel Blake. We've got Mike Lee, whose new movie Peterloo opens in the UK this Friday. And then finally, we're very glad to be joined by Hugh Grant. So you're going to be hearing the interviews from all those three coming up on this show. Hope you enjoy it. And if you do and you want to come along and see the live show, just go to the BFI box office and check it out. As I said, it's every month. We've been going for 3 years. We plan on carrying on for 10 years more. Hello, everybody. Fabulous to see you all here. We've got an absolutely packed show tonight, and I'm going to sort of race through the early stuff because I want to get onto the guests. Some of you will know some of them already. However, I'm going to pretend to keep everybody in suspense by not saying anybody's names in advance. We usually start by doing a couple of questions from the audience that people have tweeted in advance. I want to rush straight into these. Is Jane, is that you, darling? Is she here? Yeah, Jane. Go ahead, because I believe me, I struggled with getting this in the right order. Your question was?
How do you rank the four Star Is Born
movies? How do you rank the four Star Is Born movies? And I warn you, there is a correct answer to this. And in true Nick Hornby fashion, I have tied myself up in knots about it, okay? So here is the definitive from fourth to first, okay? I hate to do this. At number four, The Wellman, okay? And I know there are great reasons for The Wellman, but the thing is, it doesn't have songs in it. It's just, you know, it's great. It's the original, fine, brilliant, sets everything in motion, bloody, bloody, blah. But of all of them, is probably the least entertaining, although historically very, very important. At number three, and I know this is going to ruffle some feathers, The Babs. Because it's not meant to be Kris Kristofferson. It's meant to be Elvis. You know, don't do that face. I haven't been saying this for years. Oh, he's coming up with that. Yeah, it should. It should have been Elvis. It actually ended up being Kris Kristofferson because Colonel Tom Parker, who was neither a colonel nor a Tom Parker, prevented Elvis from doing it because it wasn't his idea. Barbara Streisand wanted Elvis to do it. Actually, she would have been, I think her choice was fabulous. Number two, The New, the Bradley Cooper, the Lady Gaga, because I thought it was great, I thought it was really fabulous, and I really enjoyed it, and I was amazed by the onstage sequences, and I really did believe that Bradley Cooper was a superstar, and I really did believe that Lady Gaga wasn't a superstar, which was a really major achievement at the beginning. But the best of all of them is still the Judy version. It's the one that holds up the most. It doesn't matter which version you see it in. It's heartbreaking, and it's brilliant. I just have to ask, Linda, my wife, are you here? Did I get it right? I did. Thank you very much. Okay. It's always worrying. Okay, is Tori Doki here?
Hello.
Hello, Tori.
I can't remember my question.
Shall I read it out for you? Here's what we'll do. I'll read it out for you, okay, because it's
a good question.
And then everyone pretend that I didn't, okay? Yeah. And then, so what you said was, I'll do it in a whisper, I'll do it sotto, a stage whisper, okay? If you've read the source material for a script, a novel, short story, play, etc., do you find it easy to detach from that when watching the adaptation? What was your question, Tori?
If you've seen a film and you've read or seeing the original source material, like a play or a text, do you find it easy to detach from that, and what makes an adaptation successful?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you... I tell you, the honest answer to it is, you know, people say, you know, do you have a problem detaching from the source? 99.9% of the times, I haven't read the source. Partly because nowadays there's 12, 14 films released every week. People say, you know, have you seen Breaking Bad? I know I haven't got 35 hours to spare. And so generally, the source material, unless it was something I read when I was... Because I don't read anything like enough. I mean, most of the time, I'm just trying to catch up with movies. So I read the Ted Chiang for Arrival because it's a short story. I read the Jane Austen for Love and Friendship because, again, it was an easily digestible source. I haven't read The Hate U Give, which everybody says, you know, you really need to read the book. So I find it very easy to detach because I haven't read it. And generally, in terms of what makes the best adaptations, it's weird how many times the best screen adaptations are from short stories. I mean, look at all the stuff that Stephen King did. Stephen King's short stories made better films than any of his long stories did. So, I mean, Shawshank Redemption is a short story, and Stand By Me is a short story. And there's a reason why... You know, The Shining creates such a problem for everybody because, you know, Stephen King wrote a longer version of it. I mean, I read The Shining the first time. I never thought it's great, but it's a bit short. He could just do another 300 pages. So the trick is to get something that you bring something out of that wasn't perhaps in the original. I mean, there's a brilliant adaptation of Falling Angel, that William Hjortsberg thing by Alan Parker, which he did as Angel Heart. And actually, that film is a huge improvement on the novel. I mean, the novel's fine, but the novel's a little bit kind of, you know, trashy. And the same is true of things like what Wild at Heart would do with their source material. So the trick is, find something that wasn't great and make it great. And finally, Davy Joe, are you here?
Hello. I've got the man flu, so might not make it through the day.
And just to be clear, the man flu is different to every other flu because
it's 15% worse.
15% worse. That's right.
I've done my own studies.
Yeah, very good. And, you're looking very well on it, and you were still able to come out tonight. But that's great. I can tell you're ill.
Yeah, thank you. So I was wondering your top 5 or top 10 contagious diseases.
Yeah, I'm not doing top 10. Top 5 is what you said in the tweet. Give me a break. I've got a job, right? I've got a load of... I was watching Peterloo earlier this... You know, so... Okay, top 5 contagion movies. Very quickly, I would lie and say they're off the top of my head, but actually I did this in the dressing room. So, number 5, The Crazies, the George Romero, right? Absolutely brilliant. Fabulous thing. Always on a double bill and late nights with Eraserhead for some reason. It did the late night circuit around the Scala and the Phoenix and all that with Eraserhead. Number 4, Contagion, okay? Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film, which I love, and I love it for one very, very simple reason, because I saw that film at exactly the point that film criticism was having this huge crisis because of the internet, and all these people kind of, there's a thing about, oh, the internet's going to destroy film criticism, and there's a line in it in which Jude Law is a blogger, and he says, I'm a journalist, you know, I've got to do it for my writing, and somebody says, blogging isn't writing, it's graffiti with punctuation. Which actually isn't true, because there's no punctuation in blogging. And welcome to all the bloggers who are here tonight. It's marvellous to see so many young faces. At number 3, I kind of sort of stretch this, The Thing, the John Carpenter version of The Thing, which I think is a contagion movie. I mean, I know it's actually a parasite moving from... But because, you remember there's the scene with the Petri dishes, when everyone's got a bit of their blood and they're sticking the thing in, and you think it's going to be the guy at the end, and they stick it at the one before, and the blood leaps out of the thing? That scene. If you haven't seen it, that wouldn't have made any sense, but believe me, it's a great scene. At number 2, and I say this because nobody went to see it, The Girl with All the Gifts, which is really great. It's a really... Isn't that a great film? No one went to see it. It's astonishing because it's a really, really good movie. Actually found a new way of doing something with a kind of zombie infection thing. Brilliant cast, really, really well done. British movie, you know, homegrown, lots of weight behind it. Never found the audience it should have done, and it's really, really good. And at number 1, my favourite infection movie, David Cronenberg shivers because, 1, it's a fantastic science fiction movie. 2, it's a David Cronenberg movie. And 3, it's a contagion movie about venereal disease that ends with a happy ending when everyone gets VD. And I can't think of another movie in which that's true. Okay, so the London Film Festival has astonishingly happened. I mean, it's, you know, it's a huge, great, big festival. There is somebody who's been here before on MK3D about 2 years ago came on to talk about I, Daniel Blake. And she's had 2 films, not 1, but 2 films, at the London Film Festival. And we are absolutely thrilled to welcome her back to the stage. Please welcome back to MK3D, Hayley Squires.
Thank
So, okay. Firstly, we've been incredibly busy since you were last. Was it two years ago you were here for?
Yeah, two years ago in December.
Wow.
Mad.
And what have you been doing recently other than the two films that we'll talk about in just a moment? You've been on stage?
I've been on stage. I've been doing two plays for the Harold Pinter season that's happening. Acting with Poirot. I need to stop calling him that. Yeah. With the Souche. Acting with the Souche, which has been brilliant.
Do you call him the Souche to his face?
We call him that, yeah.
Really?
He loves it.
You say, hello, Mr. the Souche.
Here he is, the Souche, normally. Yeah.
And is he really cool in real life?
He's the nicest man in the world.
Oh.
He's the nicest, kindest, funniest man in the world. The first day of rehearsals, he just finished a play in Bath that's actually transferring to the West End. He's doing an Arthur Miller play. And he came in, and he's 72. There was myself, John McMillan and Russell Tovey, all very nervous. And he came in and was just so excited. And he was talking about what costumes he was going to wear and ideas for dressing gowns, and it was just like a kid.
Aww.
It was good.
And you've been writing. Are you allowed to tell us about what you're writing? Can you maybe hint, gesture towards
the postal
district?
I've just finished the first draft of my first ever screenplay, and it's just gone into BBC Films, who have commissioned it, but I'm nervous because we haven't met and I'm worried that they're going to tell me it shouldn't be anything that I've written. It's about three generations of women in a family in Kent.
Okay.
And specifically about the middle woman, who, all being well, will be me, who comes...
So you're writing and you're going to star?
Yes, fingers crossed.
Wow.
And she comes back to her hometown after spending some time in prison, and it's about her relationship with her mum and with her niece. And there's some stuff to do with bare-knuckle boxing and her fighting women in warehouses and drug dealing and lots of other gangster-type stuff.
Wow. And you finished the first draft, and it is as you want it to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's long. Like, it's too long.
Okay.
But yeah, for a first draft, I mean, this is the official first draft. I've written about eight versions of that before I let anyone look at it. So we meet in a couple of weeks to find out what they're going to do.
Is it nerve-wracking?
Yeah, it's terrifying.
So have you sent it? Have they got it now? Are they now reading it?
Yes, the BBC Films have got it. I mean, they knew, they obviously, because they commissioned it, it took a lot to get it there. We go in and talk about development, and it's going to be this, and it's going to be that, and I had to kind of put a bit of a spin on it where I said... bare knuckle fighting in space. No, I said to them that it's, you have to frame it in a certain way, and I said to them that it was kind of my cry of feminism about the women that I know and have grown up with, and actually, for me, when I said that, it was kind of like a way to get people to understand it, and now that's something that's very much stuck in my head. It's about women and how they empower themselves within this certain world.
Sounds fantastic. I've never been in a script meeting when, presumably if you write something, every word is very, very precious, and then presumably you go into a meeting and they'll tell you what they like and what they don't like.
Mm.
Are you... Okay. Are you all right with that?
Well, it's my first one, so I don't know, but no, it's... So, Eva Yates and Rose Garnett at BBC Films, who are both two fantastic women, and it's amazing that they're now running BBC Films. And they're excited about it, I think, so we'll see. It's going to be... It's always hard, isn't it? Because you're kind of putting your... self out there in your words, and then you have to listen to people's. But we're all working towards the same thing.
Okay. If you make it, will you come here and talk about it?
Yes.
Yeah, promise?
Yeah. Okay. In about 6 years' time, yeah, okay. I will do.
But will you come here first?
Yes.
Like before everybody else, before Jonathan Ross and all that.
Oh, yeah, definitely
Graham
before
Norton
Jonathan Ross.
And all that stuff, you know.
Definitely before Jonathan Ross,
okay.
I'll be here.
All right, okay. So, two films at the LFF. The first was directed by Ben Wheatley. Tell us about it. I mean, in both cases, I'm going to ask you to sort of explain what the films are, because neither of them fit very neatly into a category. So tell us first about the Ben Wheatley.
So Ben's film, I keep forgetting that it's called that, because it was originally called Colin Uranus. For a good reason. The backstory of it, I don't think Ben will mind me saying this, is that when he was making High Rise, Tom Hiddleston was doing Coriolanus on stage, and Ben was going to meet him to discuss High Rise. And Ben got to the end of Coriolanus and didn't have a clue what it was about. And then Wikipedia'd it, fell in love with the story, and decided to do his version of it. So this is about a very large family who all get together over New Year in a big castle in Dorset and subsequently tear each other apart with lots of laughter along the way, but they have a big old ruck.
Okay, we've got a clip. Can we see a clip from him?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Why did you invite David?
Because it's his right.
So you invited him, but you don't want him here.
Because what I believe doesn't get in the way of what is right. It's two things.
Well, it was nice chatting. Better get back in. Do you want me to call someone?
No. You're the one who loves the sound of his own voice. You don't understand that criticism is an action. Action is action.
When Ben was doing a Q&A with the screening here, he was asked to describe it, and he said that many people had said that when he made Sightseers that he'd basically ripped off Nuts in May. And he said, OK, so this time we've ripped off Abigail's Party, because he's basically working his way through the Mike Lee back catalogue. Is there an element of that?
That's quite accurate, I'd say, yeah. They're all kind of trapped in this place where they don't really want to be, with everybody with their own agenda. Neil Maskell plays my brother, and Sam Riley is our other brother, and he's the kind of black sheep of the family who hasn't been around for 5 years, and I've kind of thrown a grenade in there and decided to invite him along to this party. And it then all unravels quite quickly, and everybody sort of turns on each other, and the hero that comes out of it is not who you expect it's going to be. But it's not, that makes it sound really heavy, and it isn't. It's actually very funny, because you can kind of look at it, and it's family dynamics, which, you know, if you don't laugh about, you're probably going to cry.
And it was a passion project, because everybody worked on it for very, very little. It was Rook Films made it themselves, yeah. Without distribution.
So Rook Films, which is Ben and Andy Stark's company, I was working on In Fabric, the Peter Strickland film at the time, and there was lots of talk about Ben making this film in January, and that he was using the same crew, and Rook Films didn't have a studio, they were doing it by themselves, because they wanted to make something. They were just, you know, there's a lot of different projects they've had on the go, and for one reason or another, they haven't quite materialised yet. And Ben just wanted to do something. And so we got this group of actors together, and it was just, I think there was about 15, 20 of us, and we all went and stayed in this castle. We shot it in a castle in Dorset, on this weird island that no one ever leaves. And we all stayed in the caravan. They don't. It's called Portland, and there's like weird bumper stickers about always living there. It's strange. We stayed in the caravan site next door. And we did it right at the beginning of January, so it was just a brilliant way to start the year.
And then BBC have picked it up, so it's going to get a theatrical release in the next few weeks.
So they made it for themselves, and then BBC Films viewed it, and BBC Comedy.
Yeah.
And I think it might be one of the first times they've done something like this. They looked at it and went, we love this. So they're going to put it on BBC Two at some point between Christmas and New Year. It all came down to Rook Films going, how do we get the most people to see this?
Yeah.
When it comes to independent film, distribution is a huge problem. And so this is the best way of doing that, getting it to the widest audience. So it will go on to BBC Two, and then they're going to keep it on iPlayer for a year. And next month, Ben is doing a tour, a Q&A tour with it. And if you look on social media, you'll be able to find the dates for it.
Great. Now, you mentioned that this came together whilst you were doing the Peter Strickland film, which is the other film that you had at the LFF. I mean, I'm a huge Peter Strickland fan. I remember seeing Barbarian Sound Studio and being completely knocked out, but I absolutely love Kathleen Vaga. Tell us about the Peter Strickland film, because, again, it's not something I think I can adequately say, oh, well, it's a horror thriller about a possessed dress.
That's quite good, actually.
Oh, is it? Okay,
yeah. It's quite good. No, it's really hard, isn't it? I described it as a story about a haunted dress set in Reading. But we that's what it is. We shot it in Croydon. But, oh, God, how you said to me before, didn't you? Make sure you know what it is, because it's very hard to describe. So it's a story about this red haunted dress that is being sold in an old kind of Are You Being Served style department store, where these mad people who kind of look like vampires but aren't, you don't really know what their deal is in terms of where they come from, are they human, are they not?
Yeah.
And this dress is sold to different people, it's passed along to different people. To begin with, it's Marianne Jean-Baptiste, and then it gets passed on to myself and Leo Bill, and it basically destroys people's lives.
Okay, so it's a horror thriller about a killer dress.
Yes.
Yeah, fine, very good.
Laughs thrown in.
Very good. Shall we see a clip?
Yeah.
I had a sleeping dream I was a size 36. And I went out with my friends to Zinzan's to celebrate, but it wasn't Zinzan's. It was here. That was where it was. It was in this room and in this catalogue. Every image was of me in this slip getting skinnier and skinnier, but the measurements written next to me were getting bigger and bigger. I rang the staff bell for assistance. Two ladies came to my aid and told me to put my head between my knees whilst they tried to correct the catalogue.
What's it like when you read? Because I can't imagine reading that on the page, because so much of what Peter Strickland does is in camera. What's it like when you read the script?
Well, I read the script. I was doing a play at the time, and I read the script came through to me and was asked to do a tape for it, which I ended up not doing. I just had a conversation with Peter for about an hour because I don't really know how to play this. Having read the script and everything that's on the page, it's not a case of, there's no sort of improvisation around it at all. It's very, very strict what's on there. But reading it and then seeing the film, it's Peter Strickland, it's his eye. He's got there's a level of detail in the world, and it's like he's the only person who can really see it fully. Yeah. Even Ari Wagner, who was the DOP on it, who's fantastic, she's absolutely brilliant, who did amazing work on it. It was like as much as we could all do our work, he was the only one that was ever going to see that world as it then became. So there's some nuts things that happen in this that I was reading in the script going, I don't know what this is going to look like or really what this means. And he's managed to make it mean something and put it into a context and make it move you.
And did you do it because it's him? We have found his previous work.
Well, I rang my dad and said, Peter Strickland wants to talk to me. And he said, whatever he wants you to do, just do it. So, yes, I was. And then I had a conversation with him, and a Skype conversation with him for about an hour. And we were talking about where this idea came from, and his idea about the character having body dysmorphia. And a lot of it's about him and women and how he understands the women that he's known in his life.
Yeah.
And I just love the way that he understands them and the kind of humour in it, but also the darkness in it.
So this opens in March. Colin Bursey, we can see in the next month or so in cinemas, and then on BBC over Christmas. And your script, does it have a name?
Yes, it does. It's called Gentle in the Bones.
So Gentle in the Bones we will hopefully see in the next year, something like that, 18 months?
Yeah, let's all cross our fingers.
Fine, okay. And when it happens, you come here first. You don't speak to any of the other famous people.
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Ladies and gentlemen, Hayley Squires, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, the lot of the Weekly Film Critic is that every Monday and Tuesday you see the films that come out on Friday. And it's always, you never know what order anything's going to be in. It's often very strange. You go from one movie to another, and sometimes it's quite disorientating. This morning, however, I had a very, very powerful experience, which is that the second screening of the day was Peterloo, which you've probably all heard about and read about. It is a really, really powerful film. And I'm still kind of coming to terms with the experience of seeing it. But to speak about it, please welcome to the stage Mike Lee.
Another fine mess you've got me in.
Welcome to the show, Mike. I can't believe that in the 3 years that we've been running, this is the first time you've been here.
Well, I've refused every week for 3 years.
I know, it was getting like stalking, wasn't it? I thought you might take out an injunction. So anyway, Peterloo is a very, very powerful piece of cinema. I read an interview with you in which you said that you were astonished at how little this piece of history is known, how little this piece of history is properly taught. So on the off chance that people don't know, can you tell us basically what Peterloo is about?
200 years ago, 2% of the population in this country had the vote. And in August 1819, there was a massive, peaceful demonstration in Manchester. Principally, people wanted the vote, but also they were demonstrating about the conditions of their lives, really, which was tough, a tough time for working folk. And peaceful though it was, the demonstration, and people showed up in their Sunday best on a Monday, they took a day off work, there were no weapons. The authorities went in and it became the Peterloo Massacre, because that's what it was. The film we've made finally culminates, does it not, with the massacre itself, but you see a whole range of people from all sides who are, in one way or another, part of this saga.
Is this something that you've wanted to make for a while? Because everything you do has the feel of a passion project, but this does feel like something that was very...
This is a weird thing. I grew up in Manchester, and many of us that did knew nothing about it. I mean, I grew up literally You could get on the bus in 15 minutes to where it happened. Nobody really talked about it. It's a strange thing. And when we worked on the film, a whole bunch of us who from the Northwest, and there's lots of people from the, lots of actors from the region, from the area, are in the picture. People ranging from their 20s to, I'm in my mid-70s, you know. And we all said, no, we didn't know anything about it. Some people did. Mm-hmm. And now there is, people are starting to know about it. And yet, historically, if you look at it, it was a major event. It was a major landmark in the history of democracy and the whole of the 19th century. You know, you had Chartists and the rise of the unions, socialism, and eventually people getting everybody universal suffrage.
Is there anything about the particular time now that makes this any more relevant than it would have been at any other time?
We decided to make the film about 5 years ago, just after we finished Mr. Turner. And as soon as we started to prepare it, almost on a daily basis, we found ourselves saying, you know what, this is really relevant. It's becoming increasingly so. And we started preparing it before Brexit, before Donald Trump.
Those halcyon days.
Good times. Remember them? I mean, you know, we couldn't have anticipated what was going to happen. So it is increasingly relevant.
Because of the way that your process works, everyone that we see on screen, everyone is thoroughly researched. You do, you know, you tell them to go away and research their characters. And there's a lot of history to absorb. So presumably there was a very, very long period of researching, because it's a huge project, Mike.
It's huge. I mean, we researched for a good long while before we got stuck into the preparation period with the actors. We spent, as always, 6 months doing that stuff with the actors. I mean, I have to say, I would probably say this about any of my films, but it's certainly the case with this one. I was served by a most fantastic gang of brilliant actors, and really great character actors, people, intelligent actors, actors who could not only act, of course, but, you know, could research and understand what we were doing and improvise and do all that stuff, you know. And no egos, you know, people really working together, and it was great. There are 150 or so named characters in the film.
I'd like to show a couple of clips. The first clip we're going to show is early on in the film, in which they're talking about the meeting which is coming up, which is going to be a peaceful meeting, and there is not universal approval that this is necessarily such a great idea. Here's a clip.
There's going to be a big march.
Aye, Mother. At Peter's Field.
Outside.
Aye.
Nor indoors.
No.
In broad daylight.
Yes.
On a Monday.
A Monday?
I know, it's daft.
Second Monday in August.
Not go to work?
Aye. We'll have to make do without us.
Well, get the sack.
Not if all the mills turn out.
Playing with fire?
No, Mother, this one will be different.
Different how?
Well, there's hundreds going. Women and children and all.
To turn out in our Sunday best.
Aye.
Oh, well, I best get my darning needles out then.
The film starts on a battlefield and in some ways, you know, ends on what's described as a battlefield. But the triumph of it is that in the move towards, you said it ends with the Peterloo massacre. But in the build-up towards that, you do get this sense of getting to know the individual characters, as has always been the case with your films, and women, children, peaceful marching. This is the thing which is stressed. So that as we move towards what finally happens, we really feel invested in the lives and the struggles of the people whose, you know, whose stories we are following. When so many intertwining stories, Mike, is it easy to move the narrative through that? I mean, I know this is something that you've done before, but on this scale, it is quite extraordinary.
Well, I appreciate what you say, and it certainly was a task. I mean, there are several things to say about that. First of all, I think what is important is that we film directors, unlike painters and novelists and poets, we don't make films by ourselves. You know, it's a great collaboration of very talented people, not only on the artistic side, but on the organisational side, on both, and people on both sides of the camera, obviously. So I think there's all that. But also, speaking from what I think is the point of view of the question, which is my role as the dramatist, if you like, as the film, as the author of the film. I mean, you know, whether you take, whether I'm dealing with, as I frequently have, two or three people fighting, knocking lumps off each other on a staircase in a suburban house, or whether it's this, I mean, it's still a narrative. It still has to live. It still has to be organic. It still has to be spontaneous. It still has to be real. So it's just a question of keeping a level head and dealing with it and, you know, organising it.
You talked about the number of credited cast. There is the scenes when we actually see the march and the meeting itself, and they look enormously expansive. I read somewhere that, in fact, the number of extras that you had actually was not huge, that what you were doing is you're employing smart camera angles and using a little bit of CGI.
A lot of CGI,
okay. Well, I'd like to just show a clip from the sort of the last movement of the film, because I think it does give people a sense of the scope of what happens, okay?
White hat. There. Look,
it's on the beach.
Caesar himself.
And the women.
They're getting out.
And the fact that there you have, you know, say, how do, and the smiling faces, and it does make what we know is coming all the more horrendous. What do you hope that an audience takes away from the film? I mean, is it primarily to tell them a story that they perhaps don't know? What do you want them to take from it?
You know what? You know this very well. I've never made a film where I say to the audience, think this, you know? I always leave you to take away stuff to ponder, argue about, meditate about, reflect on, consider, well, maybe that should have happened, or this might have happened, or why did that happen, or all kinds of stuff. And in the end, although, of course, this film is, in the most obvious sense, the most overtly political film that I've made, that's to say, it deals with politics, yeah. But it's not the only time that's happened. In my films. This film is no exception in the sense of it is not for me to say, finally, it's about this. I leave you, as you know, and when folks see it, they will know, that I leave you in a very emotional place. You sympathise, there are things to be angry about, there are things to remember and reflect about, etc. And certainly, since no audience can possibly decode and process a film other than in terms of how we are in our own lives now, that is what can and must and is the only thing that can happen when you watch the film.
I want to ask you finally an aesthetic question. I was very struck watching the film, which it does have these very expansive scenes, but there are scenes of families and friends indoors, and I was looking at certain compositions and I thought that's very painterly, and I was thinking of Vermeer, and I was very, very struck by the cinematography. Of course, you know, you're a brilliant cinematographer. And I was thinking that Tim Spall came on the show some time ago after he'd done Mr. Turner. And I want to ask you whether or not working on Mr. Turner affected your eye.
It's a more complicated matter than that, really. I mean, Dick Pope, the cinematographer, and I have been working together. He's shot everything I've done since Life is Sweet in 1990. We're obviously on the same wavelength. Our collaboration involves working together, but also in a creative way, pushing each other and pushing ourselves so that we, you know, from the extreme way that we shot, that he photographed naked, to the reference of Turner that informed this film, to the way that he researched Victorian theatre lighting for Topsy Turvy. All of those things are cumulative. So it probably would be actually dishonest and perhaps even a bit disingenuous for me to pretend that there was a very simple progression from Mr. Turner to Peterloo. Obviously, in both cases, we're dealing with the early 19th century. One of the things that isn't quite what you're talking about, but nonetheless informed some decisions about what you see visually in Peterloo, are the caricatures of Rowlandson and Gilray and Cruikshank, right. Particularly when you see the scenes of the Prince Regent and his mistress and things. It's very much that's going on as well. But in the end, it's all about looking at this, certainly the stuff you mainly think about, it's all about the look of the place and the grit and grime of the world that we're depicting.
I've interviewed you several times over... I mean, I've been a film journalist for something like 30 years. I can't remember the first time. One of the things I love about you the most is you have the most elegant way of answering no I have ever heard from a filmmaker.
Well, now, actually, I want to talk about that.
Congratulations on the new film. It opens on Friday, and I think it's a wide release, yes, so people will be able to see it around the country. Yeah. I wish you every success with it. I fully expect it to turn up in the forthcoming awards season. I know that awards are...
I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay. Thank you for coming on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Lee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, after this MK3D, there's going to be an MK4D in which we ask somebody to introduce a guilty pleasure, a film that they feel particularly strongly about that perhaps isn't universally accepted as a stone-cold classic. Before he introduces his guilty pleasure for MK4D, please welcome to the stage the very wonderful Mr. Hugh Grant.
How are you?
Yes.
Hugh.
How could you have a list of the 13 best horror films and not include The Lair of the White Worm?
Ah! Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Hugh, because, in fact, let's start there, because I wasn't going to go there, but since you did. So, Lair of the White Worm, which is a film directed by Ken Russell, who... I have to say, still, one of the great underrated British geniuses, because despite the fact that Ken Russell was at one point, I think, the only British director ever to have three films playing simultaneously in the West End, that he made, Women in Love and The Devils, which is the great desecrated work of British cinema, and yet isn't recognised on the same... Sorry, I'm going to stop going on about this, but the man's a genius. You worked with him. What was it like?
Well, I loved him, and he was very genuinely funny. It was a very strange experience because this horror film script arrived and he wanted me to be in it, and we all took it very... horror film, right? And then there was a read-through the night before we started shooting, or the day before, and as we read it, the cast couldn't keep a straight face. And I saw him looking slightly uneasy, partly because his wife had written it. Or adapted it from the Bram Stoker thing, and he shot it, therefore, as a semi-comedy, I think. I assume it was a semi-comedy. We never really knew. But he was lovely. He was fantastic in the mornings, and then in the afternoons, in those days, he had a good lunch.
Had a good lunch.
He had a very good lunch. And his directing technique in the afternoon was not classic. In terms of how you handle actors. I remember doing a scene in it where I had to pick up a broadsword and chop a woman in half, as you do in a Ken Russell film.
Ken Russell film, yeah.
Yeah. And I said, after a few takes, I said, Ken, that doesn't feel quite right. And he said, fuck how it fucking feels. Do it how I fucking showed you, you
c- But you had a... It was a pleasant experience and you have fond memories of the finished film, obviously. The finished film is nuts.
It's not. People who smoke a lot of pot love it. But it was very sad. I remember the opening night and thinking, funny, no one's invited me to a premiere, and it's because there wasn't one. It was shown, I think, in one cinema pretty much in the Haymarket. And I went with some friends, and the whole cinema was completely empty except for a little group in the far corner, which was Amanda Donoghue and her friends. it was a bit sad.
Now, Hugh, one of the reasons that you're here, other than to talk about your guilty pleasure, which we will get to, is that there is what I think is officially referred to as awards buzz at the moment around Very English Scandal, which, of course, played on the BBC and is now available through, you know, Amazon and streaming services. And it's an extraordinary performance. And I was, weirdly enough, I was in BAFTA when they did the preview of it. And I didn't know. This is you probably won't remember this.
I do. You were sitting sadly at a table.
I was sitting working. Yeah. That's what I looked like when I was working.
I remember who's that man with no friends? Oh.
Yeah, can Mark I
come
on?
Yeah.
I'd like to say what actually happened, Hugh, was that I was working very intently and suddenly all these really starry people start turning up. You know, Stephen Frears and everyone's there, and then somebody said anything, and of course it was that they were doing the screening of the whole thing. And then you came up to my table, and I was so starstruck, and you went, Mark, how are you? And I thought, God, Hugh Grant knows who I am. And then you said, are you here for my thing? And I said, no, I'm here for Simon Mayo's book launch. And I thought...
Yeah, it was hurtful.
I imagine that most people have seen it, but for those who haven't, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the scandal the first time around. For those who haven't, give us the quick background to the scandal.
Well, it was Jeremy Thorpe was the leader of the Liberal Party in the 70s and a great member of the establishment, old Etonian, ex-Oxford, very well connected, beautifully dressed, debonair, charming, and charismatic, and led the Liberals to their sort of greatest electoral successes that they've ever had, actually. But meanwhile, harboured the secret, which was that he was gay, despite being married, and he'd had an affair back in the 60s, and with a man who sort of hounded him for the next 20 years, and to the point where Thorpe appears to have put out a hit on him, a very amateurish hit that went very badly wrong, and they got the dog, not the man.
It's still astonishing to think this really did happen in the relatively recent past.
Yes. Yes, I don't know how many hits are taken out nowadays in the House of Commons. But having spent 6 years sort of doing hacked off stuff, yeah, and spending a lot of time in the House of Commons, talking to a lot of MPs, I was always struck by the similarity of the type of person who goes into politics and show business. And, you know, the person who called politics show business for the ugly, I think, was right. Because there's this extraordinary look-at-me narcissism going on, and that was a key to Jeremy Thorpe. It was, you know, look at me, and don't you dare try and ruin my career, Norman Scott, because if you do, I'll kill you.
Could you give us a thumbnail of how you got into the character of Jeremy Thorpe? Because I was really, really struck. As I said, I remember seeing this on the news when it first happened. And obviously, I think I've seen all of your films, Hugh. And I was really struck by how much you'd managed to capture. I mean, was the gait or the poise? Because you don't actually look in real life very much like Jeremy Thorpe, but on screen you do absolutely embody, as I remember that character being on the news.
Well, I had a very good makeup guy. Who I actually rather queenly said I shan't do this film without him, because he is very good at sort of finding just a few things that, you know, change you quite dramatically and lean towards the character without it becoming a load of prosthetic nonsense.
So in the case of Jeremy Thorpe, what would a few of those things be?
Hair, which he shaved this front bit off, which made me, I'm told, unshaggable for 6 months. And amazing, just that difference. My children cried when I saw them. And I lost a lot of weight. I went hairing around Richmond Park on a bicycle for months and things like that, and brown contact lenses. But then I did, you know, he's there on YouTube. And I found quite early on that I could do a sort of imitation of him. And then I thought, I can't just do an imitation, you know. Ben Whishaw's in this, he'll be doing proper acting. I got out of it. So I did do a lot of digging as well into, you know, books, and I met lots of people who knew him and tried to piece him together in the way that you are meant to, in a sort of Stanislavski kind of way.
Okay. Yeah. Shall we see this? As I said, this is a montage. This is from throughout the drama, and I think they give people a sort of sense of the overview of the scope of it. So let's have a look.
I need you to see him in person and warn him off. And I mean, seriously, go and put the shits up him, little sod. You tell him that that amounts to blackmail and that he will have the full weight of the law upon his head if he ever tries anything like that again. And you make it very clear that he is not to contact me ever, he is not to talk about our former association in any shape or form, and he is not to write to my mother describing acts of anal sex under any circumstances whatsoever.
For God's sake, Jeremy, we're members of Parliament. We can't sit here and discuss murder.
No, I really don't care. I don't care if we shoot him, or we strangle him, or we poison him, or we bludgeon him, or we tie him up in a sack and drop him in the Thames. There is only one way for us to survive. Norman Scott has got to die, so... how?
It's amazingly intense. I mean, obviously, your relationship with the director was particularly good because you'd worked with him before and you trusted each other.
Yeah, Frears on the Florence Foster Jenkins, that is true. I mean, he's mad. You've interviewed him.
Yes.
It suits me very well because he doesn't speak. And I thought he would when I accepted Florence Foster Jenkins. I thought, Christ, Stephen Frears, you know, he wins all these prizes. He's sort of arty, and there'll be a lot of talk about character and motivation and all these things, which I'm not really accustomed to doing, just romantic comedies. And so I thought of about 20 or 30 really intelligent questions about the script, and I went to meet him for a cup of tea somewhere, and I started with question one. I said, but, you know, this moment here, do you think that's a real sign of love, or is he just, maybe he's just using her? What do you think? Well, I don't know. No idea. No, I'm just the director. So, all right, well, question two. And that's how it went. He has never expressed an opinion. And I call him openly to his face an idiot savant. Because he just does it completely by instinct. And... There's a famous... I used to be a golf addict, and there's a famous golf coach in America who is on the spectrum. When you have a lesson with him, he doesn't watch you. He lies on the ground with his head turned away and listens to the sound the ball makes as you hit it. And he goes, oh, okay, you're slicing. And then tells you why you're slicing. And Frears is rather like him in that he just watches a monitor and expects to be entertained. And he can... Something will tell him if there's something wrong, but he won't be... He'll just say, do it again, do it again, do it again. And eventually you sort it out for yourself. But it's just a perfect sense of false beats. And it's instinct, yeah. I think he's brilliant on choosing material.
Yeah.
And I think he's brilliant at choosing his crew. And I think he's rather good at casting.
You mentioned Florence Foster Jenkins, which I absolutely loved, and I'd like to show a clip from it, which actually is, you know, you said the question was, does he really love her or is he just using her? And actually, I think one of the great things about the film is it does raise that question, but during the course of the drama, there are certain moments in which you see real tenderness between them, and you do see him as somebody who is loving, as you know, as well as opportunist. This is one of my favourite scenes, and this is him basically seeing her to sleep. And she's been unwell throughout the course of their entire relationship because of what happened in her first marriage. And I think there is real tenderness and heart in this sequence. So let's have a look.
Now, my bunny, you must sleep.
I don't want this day to end.
I know. Shut your eyes.
Only if you recite for me.
Very well. Let me not, to the marriage of true minds, admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove.
It's such a beautiful one. I love that film because I think that it does manage to do that thing about you're not laughing at her. you are laughing with her. And, you know, that although it is very, very funny, because she has this thing about being, the worst singer in the world, and there are moments of high comedy in it, but you feel simply, and I think you do, because your character makes us feel that.
Yes, it's all down to me, I agree. No, but I don't quite agree with you. I think you laugh with her and at her,
okay,
which is what I think is interesting, actually, with the Idiot Savant's films, is that he likes to...
Are we just going to call him that from now on?
He likes to sort of dick around with genre and tone, saying, well, what is this? What are you watching here? You know, and I think that's sort of what he's up to.
One of the things that you've developed a very self-deprecating line, and you know, just earlier on, you said, oh, romantic comedies, like that. And in this, you're playing somebody who is, a not very successful actor. There's a hint that he may at some point have been, but it hasn't really happened. And then, of course, in Paddington, you play this incredibly pompous performer who, keeps rooms of his trophy. And you have developed in later life a kind of something which almost looks like a sort of self-referential laughing, laughing at yourself in a way which is, I think, really, really brilliant and very, very sort of telling, because you've played bad actors more than once and you are a very, very accomplished, serious actor, but you're very offhand about yourself. Like you say, oh, romantic comedies, like anyone could do it.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, the last three things I've done, I have effectively been offered parts of roaring narcissists. And I think about that sometimes. To have been offered one might be considered a misfortune. what else can I tell you? I mean, yes, that's what they are.
Can we enjoy a clip of you being a roaring narcissist in Paddington 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
Prison is no laughing matter. And I should know, I spent 3 years in Les Miserables.
Mr. Buchanan, you live on the same street as the defendant.
I do.
And you were an eyewitness to the events that night.
Indeed, I was. I was up late when I became aware of a hullabaloo in the street below. I went to my awards room, which is a large room overlooking the newspaper kiosk, and I saw young Paddington riding a rather disreputable-looking hound.
Do you want to explain the tweet that you did recently at the football match with the person holding up the sign? I think you should say this because I don't want to say it.
I'm not a natural tweeter, but I was sort of forced onto it by my hacked-off friends. I never, ever tweet about show business or my career or anything like that. Yuck. But I happened to see, just as the Thorpe film was coming out on Amazon in America, I saw a tweet of some people at the World Cup, some Aussie fans holding up a sign saying, "Fuck Paddington." And so I put that picture on Twitter, and underneath I said, "I did." A very English scandal opens on Amazon on Friday.
Was Paddington fun to do? I mean, it must be weird, because when you on set, who is Ben Whishaw there doing? Because he did the voice afterwards. How does it work?
No, Ben wasn't there at all. When it's a scene with the bear, who is created in a computer later, you're given a choice. They have an actress who's the right height for Paddington, who's great, very nice. I tripped over her at the premiere, actually. I don't know. In a crowded room, but she's lovely. And then there's... or you can have a stick with a bear's head on the end, which is just frightening. Yeah. And then you can have just a stick. And in the end, I went with a stick.
And it's easy to work with that?
I've known people who are harder to work with. For sure.
So, on a serious note, there is a lot of awards talk now about the Thorpe performance. Does it matter? Do you care?
Well...
I mean, I read Golden Globes being bandied about.
I don't know, because I don't really know... I don't know how that stuff works very well. But clearly, being a narcissist, any praise, you know, is just heaven.
Is it genuinely? You it's just nice because if you get a nomination, it's lovely, and if you win.
Traditionally, I've enjoyed in my acting career the parts of the job you're not supposed to enjoy. You're supposed to enjoy the work. I've always hated that. I like the money and the praise.
Okay, I'm going to end with another clip. A clip where I don't know whether you're as crazy about it as I am, because you went, romantic comedy. And I am in love with Love Actually, and I know that everyone's seen it a million times, and it's Christmas, and it's now become like It's a Wonderful Life. It's one of those things that everybody sits around and watches every single Christmas, and I think there are things in it that are just superb. And but before we do that, you're going to come back at 8:30 to introduce your guilty pleasure as part of MK4D. Would you tell us what your guilty pleasure is?
Yes, it's the Pink Panther. But I have a guilty secret about my guilty secret.
Yes.
Do I share that?
I think you should do, Hugh. I think you've shared everything else. There's no reason to stop now.
Well, this is awful because I was asked, you know, prior to this thing, give us some suggestions for your guilty secret. I came up with a few. And I thought, the Pink Panther. I used to love that, Pink Panther. And then I thought this weekend, I haven't seen it for ages, so you might have to talk intelligently to Mark Kermode about it. I better watch it again. So I got it down off iPlayer or whatever it was, and halfway through realised I'd never seen it in my life. I knew I loved Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau and Herbert Lom, you know, being his boss. There's hardly any of that in the first one.
Well, look, we shall talk at length about the entire Clouseau thing. You know, I'm sure you can do this. Can you get from Inspector Clouseau to The Exorcist in one move?
No, of course not. No.
Second, the best Inspector Clouseau film shot in the dark was written by William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist.
Don't be silly.
That's true. There we go. So, so Hugh will be back to speak intelligently and lucidly about a film of which he has seen half at 8:30. I want to end, Hugh, with a speech of yours from Love Actually. And I know that the critics can be sniffy about this. And say, it's cheesy and bloody, bloody, blah. This is a speech which, when it turns up in the film, you're playing the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister, frankly, I think we all wished we had. And this is a particularly lovely subplot, which I think is even more relevant today than it was then, in which he's had a fractious meeting with the American president, who is a boorish, groping creep. And there is this moment when suddenly there's a public press conference, and our Prime Minister stands up to the boorish, groping creep. And I remember the first time I saw it, I swelled, and I watch it again now, and I feel exactly the same way. So just before we show this, because you showed it to
swelled?
Yes, yeah, swelled. No, not swelled. Well, obviously, Hugh, your presence always makes me tumescent, but I was particularly excited by this clip. Do you want to say anything about this before we play this?
Not now.
Britain. We may be a small country, but we're a great one too. The country of Shakespeare, Churchill, the Beatles, Sean Connery, Harry Potter. David Beckham's right foot. David Beckham's left foot, come to that. And a friend who bullies us is no longer a friend. And since bullies only respond to strength, from now onward, I will be prepared to be much stronger. And the president should be prepared for that.
It's great. So, Hugh, you'll be back in about half an hour to talk us through the intricate detail of the Pink Panther. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I do wish you all the very best in the award season. I know people say it's not, you know, it's not relevant, but I think it is, and I think if you don't win, you will have been robbed. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Prime Minister we never had, Hugh Grant. I get very welled up by that because I've told this story a million times, but my wife, Linda, had to go off to a conference in America, and she went without me and our kids, and she was away and was sort of bereft. And she had the plane flight, it was 8 hours long, and so she just watched Love Actually over and over and over again for 8 hours. And by the time she came back, it was the favourite film in our household forever. So anyway, that's it for this show. Please join me in thanking, firstly, Nick, who's been doing all the visuals. Hedda, who has produced the show, as she has done for 3 years. The BFI for having us. Hayley, whose films are out just before Christmas on BBC Two, and then in March, and then within the next 2 years' time when you're going to come up here before you go and talk to Jonathan Ross and everyone else. Mike Lee, Peterloo opens on Friday. And Hugh Grant, who'll be back in half an hour. Thank you very much. See you soon. Well, there we go. That's just a flavour of the Mark Kermode Live in 3D shows that, as I said, we've been doing here at the BFI South Bank every month for about 3 years now. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you want to get in touch, the easiest way is to go to Twitter. My Twitter handle is @KermodeMovie, and just mark your question or your comment or whatever it is, #KermodeOnFilm or #KOF. Thank you for downloading. Please download the next one. And like I said, get in touch and tell us what you think we should be doing here on Kermode on Film.
You've had a nice time, haven't you? Now I'm going to kiss you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.